Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is George Stevens, Jr., who has a book, Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age, from the American Film Institute. George Stevens, Jr. is also the founding director of the American Film Institute, producer of several films, including Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line. This book consists of interviews and seminars that were conducted at the American Film Institute pretty much from the tail end of the 60s up through the 80s. The American Film Institute was founded in order to give a place for young directors and young artists to learn their craft.
That was one major purpose. The fundamental purpose was preserving the films from America's past that were deteriorating. But we did start the conservatory, the Center for Advanced Film Studies, in Los Angeles in September of 1969. And it was on that first night when Harold Lloyd, the great silent film star and producer, came and talked to just 17 fellows, the first 17 fellows at AFI. And among the question askers that night were Terrence Malick, David Lynch, Paul Schrader, Jeremy Kagan, and many who went on to become fine filmmakers in their own right.
Did they apply to get in?
We announced the opening of the Center for Advanced Film Studies, and in the first year I interviewed every applicant. I remember Terry Malick was the only one who wore a coat and tie. It was the late 60s, and 17 were selected for that first year.
And you had these seminars, and sometimes you conducted these, sometimes they took questions. What kinds of questions do you think the students asked as opposed to the kind of questions that you asked?
Well, I think we're all kind of on the same page, because what makes these interesting is that the questions are asked by prospective filmmakers, people who are trying to understand the filmmaking process, who are trying to look behind that curtain and to figure out how Alfred Hitchcock or John Huston or David Lean, how they went about their work.
There are specific questions about specific films, and in some cases it's clear that was the film that they had seen the day before.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases it's just on their current film. How do you focus on a career when a person is thinking, and maybe you're thinking, about their current project?
I think that's why the seminars vary in their tone and texture, and it also varies in the cases like Frank Capra, who came and did three or four seminars, which then kind of cover more ground. My father, George Stevens, the director of Shane Giant, A Place in the Sun, he came specifically to talk about Gunga Din, one of his early films, and then segued into Giant and Shane and A Place in the Sun later on.
Now, you knew some of these people beforehand and some you just met, right?
I knew most of them. It turns out, growing up in Hollywood, over the years, I had met King Vidor and Billy Wilder and Fred Zinnemann, and some of them were friends, some of them were acquaintances.
Among the list, let me give you a little list here of some of the people, and then there are a few that I'm going to mention who are not in the book, kind of surprisingly. Fritz Lang, Frank Capra, King Vidor, Alfred Hitchcock, George Cukor, Billy Wilder, John Huston, Ilya Kazan, David Lean, Robert Wise, Gene Kelly, Jean Renoir, Federico Fellini, and Ingmar Bergman, none of whom were Hollywood directors, or at least the last two were, along with Satyajit Ray. I came up with four names of people who weren't in there. And the four names, I'm sure there are a lot others, were Orson Welles, Ida Lupino as perhaps the only female director, or one of the two or three female directors, Charles Chaplin, and Akira Kurosawa. Why were there no women? Because there were two or three women. There was Ida Lupino and one other.
Dorothy Arzner.
Yeah, Dorothy Arzner was the other one.
Well, it happened that neither, I don't think Dorothy Arzner was alive, and I'm not sure Ida Lupino was when we started the AFI. She may have been, but she never came to do a seminar. Sadly, Orson Welles never came to do a seminar, and the one whose omission I notice is John Ford, the great American director.
Which I'll ask you about in a minute. That was at the top of my list, and,
yes.
And I recently spoke with Tony Kushner, who told me that it was his understanding that Ford never did interviews.
Well, I don't know that he never did interviews, but he was in failing health around that time. I think he died in 1973 or 4. He never came up to AFI. I knew him quite well, and he was a wonderful and garrulous fellow. Peter Bogdanovich and I made a film called Directed by John Ford in which he is very salty with his eye patch, grumbling and dismissing intellectual questions.
These folks all had different things to say, obviously. A few things stand out. Most of them worked either in or around the studio system. One thing that they would do is they would tend to film one shot from one angle, the angle that they wanted, in order to make sure that nobody would take it out of their hands and put together a different movie. And in fact, the less they shot beyond what they needed, the more sure they were that the film would be the one they wanted.
Well, that was a technique that some of them used, certainly not all of them. I think today more directors are granted a kind of control or final cut. So I think that it was one of the disadvantages of the studio system that sometimes L.B. Mayer would want to come in and change the picture around.
Today also we have these director's cuts, which means that even if the studio releases a film one way, mm-hmm. we will eventually see the other, which mm-hmm. is one of the joys of DVD. What films that we can see now, say on DVD, did American Film Institute preserve in a way that perhaps wouldn't have been preserved had you guys not existed?
Well, when we started in 1967, our first priority was preservation of American yeah. films. And at the time, we found that over half of the films that had been made since the beginning were either missing, had been lost, or were in the process of deterioration. And the AFI, in that first 15 years, preserved over 10,000 films that are in the Library of Congress. And many of them were from the silent era. Some of them, like Gunga Din, were 1939. It was a very important first step, and others, the Museum of Modern Art, UCLA, a lot of people were involved in that work.
Did you find segments of films that had been cut, for instance, that you could just put aside that maybe now have popped up on DVD?
I went to Czechoslovakia because they had, behind the Iron Curtain, this wonderful archival program. And it was in Czechoslovakia that we found one of John Ford's first silent films. It was called Straight Shootin', and it will always exist with Czech subtitles.
George Stevens, Jr., the Holy Grail, as Roger Ebert calls it, is the original Magnificent Ambersons, which brings us to Stanley Cortez, who was the lighting designer for Ambersons. He claimed that 20 minutes were missing. I've heard different stories. Is that the only story that you've heard?
No, it's one of those films around which there is great lore. Orson Welles directed it, and then went off to Brazil to make another project, and the studio really took it away from him, or his absenteeism caused them to take it away from him, whichever one's part of the story you want to believe. So nobody really knows exactly what Welles' intentions were and how close the finished film was to what he... Interestingly, Robert Wise, who later became a director, was the editor on Ambersons, and he was the one who was asked to finish the film.
I don't believe Wise talks about that specifically in here. He talks about Kane. Did you ever have a chance to talk to Wise about Ambersons?
I never did talk to him about it. But it's interesting, Stanley Cortez, whom you mentioned, was a very fine cinematographer, and he was brought in by Welles to shoot Magnificent Ambersons and did a lovely job.
Why did someone like Cortez, who was a great lighting director during the 60s, wind up making schlock films? I mean, I looked at his resume, and it kind of falls off the table. And we've seen that sometimes with older actors, but does the same thing happen with lighting designers?
It does. They need work. And if David Lean's not asking for them, they work for Stanley Lupiecz or whoever is in need of a cameraman.
I'd like to ask a few questions specifically about some quotes. This is a good one from Richard Brooks, who comes across as a bit of a paranoid.
A delightful paranoid.
This one amazes me because it seems to me, as I look at films today, that what Brooks says here has been completely thrown out the window. You shouldn't be aware of the director. The audience should never know there's a director in the film. They should never know when the music starts or ends. They should never see the camera move. They should never have to say, isn't that interesting? They should just be in the story. It seems to me that when I look at a film today, all I see is what the director is doing and what the editor is doing and what the music person is doing.
I think that's a wonderful thing you select from the book, the quote from Richard Brooks, because it is really fundamental to really good filmmaking, that the great filmmakers wanted to be invisible. They knew that if they were doing what we used to call Chinese angle, shooting up, shooting down to call attention to the camera, it takes the audience out of the emotional continuity of the film.
Did you ever talk to your father about issues like that?
Yeah, he had an expression. He said, when I'm watching a film, I always hate those shots when I can kind of picture the cameraman with his hat on backwards riding on a crane making a fancy shot.
George Stevens Jr., the only person involved in musicals, well, there's a couple of people who did musicals, but the only one directly is Gene Kelly. Let me ask you this. Why can't they film dance anymore on screen? Whenever you see dance, you see cut, 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 cut. You don't see someone dancing. I mean, it's the MTV influence, I think.
I think you're right. I remember my father made two musicals, one of which is generally considered to be the classic of the Astaire Rogers canon, Swing Time. And Francis Coppola directed a musical, and I'm having a hard time.
Finian's Rainbow.
Finian's Rainbow. And I remember my father seeing it, and he said, I really couldn't understand it. He said the feet were cut off all the time. And he knew instinctively when he made his first musical, Swing Time, to keep the camera back and see the dance. One exception to what you were saying about contemporary films, Rob Marshall, who came from the stage and did Chicago, did a beautiful job of filming dance.
I would say he didn't. You never saw Richard Gere's feet and Richard Gere's head at the same time.
Well, maybe that's because Richard Gere isn't Fred Astaire. He might have been working on another problem.
So you think it's possible that when you saw things like that in Chicago, it was because it wasn't those performers?
It might have been. Unfortunately, that tradition of the great musicals kind of coming from Broadway and then going on the screen in the Busby Berkeley era, I'm afraid that's gone.
During the recent Oscars, there was a big push for going to films in theaters. Mm-hmm. And I'm jumping the gun here, but what do you see as the future of film?
I think talking about the book, The Great Movie Makers of the Golden Age, we call it the Golden Age because there was such a great quantity of wonderful films that have survived for 50 years or more. You are really asking the question, will the films being made today, how many of those will be interesting 50 years from now?
And what's going to happen to theatrical showings as well?
Well, I think they're jeopardized. I think there will always be theaters and movies in theaters, but the competition between people having ever bigger screens at home, the accessibility of DVDs, or a cable coming into your house where you can download a movie, the theater managers are going to have to be more imaginative. I think they're going to have to stop putting commercials in front of the movies, because why do you leave home to go see commercials that you can avoid with your TiVo at home and pay to do it in the theater? And just to talk about, they all happen to be men in this book, as you pointed out.
Right.
But the men who made these films, they were making films for an audience that went to the movies three times a week. It was before television started to fragment the audience, then video cassettes, then DVD. In that time, the only way you would see a motion picture was to go to a motion picture theater. And it was a very nourishing audience for these people.
A number of the directors talk about censorship and how they had to work around censorship, more specifically thematic rather than censorship of words or naked bodies or even violence. Today we call films that were released prior to July 1934 as the pre-code era. And then the code era lasted, I guess, until the late 60s with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and mm-hmm. a few other films. At that point, when you were doing these, people didn't think about pre- and post-code, did they?
No. Interestingly, whatever the kind of constrictions were of the code, in a strange way, I think they made these films more interesting because it required the filmmakers to be somewhat imaginative in storytelling. And films that, I think to me, unless I have old-timers disease, I think they were more romantic. I think the sexual aspects of films were more interesting before you could just about do anything visibly on the screen. Let me take one example, a film of my father's, A Place in the Sun, Montgomery Clift, Elizabeth Taylor, Shelley Winters, based on Dreiser's An American Tragedy. The circumstance in that film is that Montgomery Clift, a World War II veteran coming to this town, trying to make his way, get a job, works in a factory and meets the Shelley Winters character. And then simultaneously he meets Elizabeth Taylor, the beauty, rich beauty of the town. Shelley Winters getting pregnant. The whole issue of pregnancy and her seeking an abortion, Paramount was reluctant to make the film because they thought they would have such code problems. But my father managed to tell that story in such a beautiful way, with the audience knowing exactly what's going on without ever using the word abortion, without ever using the word pregnant, and without ever the audience feeling somehow that the film was tap dancing around. It was strong and true and worked very well.
So you don't see that the code as really damaging film, as others have said?
I haven't thought of it that way, but I'm sure it constrained to some degree that was probably unfortunate. But again, I just look at the body of work that came out of that era and said, you know, say, let the chips fall where they may.
You're listening to an interview with George Stevens, Jr., whose book is Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age. You also met Monty Clift in Place in the Sun. What was he? Was he like? Was he withdrawn? Was he friendly?
He was quietly charming, and I think you could say, without offense, he was a bit neurotic. But he was a fascinating-looking young man and a wonderful actor.
And Elizabeth Taylor, she was a pro all the way?
Well, she has been a friend for many, many years, and I first knew her in A Place in the Sun and Giant and through the years, and she's a wonderful woman and a lovely actress.
Many people have said, and I tend to agree, that the greatest of all film directors, when you know, outside of Citizen Kane, putting that in its own little world, was probably Jean Renoir.
Well, he was magnificent, and people love him, and he was a wonderful, nurturing man. I know more filmmakers who speak of him with reverence, and I met him, and I remember going to his house, a little house, modest house in Beverly Hills. And he had a very colorful sweater on. He was an old man. And there were a few little paintings on the wall from his father, Auguste. He just had this warm and genial quality.
George Stevens, Jr., there isn't that much talk about social issues in these interviews, except from Stanley Kramer, who specifically talks about it. Do you think there is the disconnect between Hollywood and the mainstream that George Clooney alluded to at the Oscars?
Does the public lead Hollywood or does Hollywood lead the public?
Yeah.
Is it chicken and egg? I do not think that disconnect is as great, and I think that there's a segment of society, of the media, that's trying to make Hollywood a bit of a ghetto, saying that it's all liberal agit propaganda. You know, which it isn't. So I think that's just a passing episode.
Your father was involved in social film, certainly Place in the Sun, Diary of Anne Frank.
Giant was about race and feminism before they were really dealt with on the screen.
Did he ever talk about what role a filmmaker, an artist, has in dealing with social issues?
He was a little more elusive than that. He didn't want to be a preacher. He had strong feelings, and those feelings would come in his film, but he kind of referred to dealing with the human condition. And I think that's a graceful way of saying that it only works if it's got a real human connection with the audience.
George Stevens, Jr., we're living in an era now in which we have a right-wing, extreme right-wing president, in which there's a propaganda machine, a right-wing propaganda machine that is louder than I can recall in my life, and perhaps maybe louder than you can recall in your life, though you lived through the McCarthy era. Let me start by asking you there. You lived through these two eras. Are there similarities?
There are similarities. I don't think there's a one-for-one comparison. I mean, the McCarthy era was really this assault on individuals. The contemporary experience is a little different.
Let me ask you about the politics of today, and what Hollywood's role can be in it. And do you see the money people trying to impose some kind of censorship? Where are we now?
The money people care about money. If you can make a right-wing film that's going to make a lot of money, and they really think it's going to make a lot of money, they'll back it. If you've got a left-wing film that they think will make a lot of money, they'll back it. But they won't do it for either of those reasons.
So you see that that remains divorced. No matter how much pressure gets put on Hollywood, it's all about the money.
I do think that.
And artists themselves tend to be socially liberal because that's what artistic expression is about, I think.
I think it does. I think that there's always been a tendency in that direction, though it's not been exclusive. Cecil B. DeMille, he was a very staunch right-wing person, and for his time, the single most successful movie director of the period.
There is very little mention in your book, except from Ilya Kazan, kind of secondhand, about the blacklist.
Mm.
Did you encounter a number of blacklisted writers in your career?
Yes, and I probably didn't know at the time, because during that period I was in my 20s, and I was not as conscious of it. I was very aware of McCarthyism, and we watched the McCarthy hearings, Senate hearings. And later I would discover that people had been going through that difficult blacklist period. My father, George Stevens, had been very active in the Directors Guild, and he was central to one of those pivotal things, which was the time when Cecil B. DeMille tried to oust Joseph L. Mankiewicz, the president of the Directors Guild, because he thought he was too liberal. DeMille went into the Guild offices, got the mailing list, sent out messengers with recall ballots, but only messengers to the people he was confident were going to vote the right way. And there took place this great meeting at the Beverly Hills Hotel where the entire Directors Guild membership gathered. And my father, as someone later said, was like Clarence Darrow. He had gone to the Guild. He had came in with a red notebook and really dissected DeMille. And famously, at that meeting, Joe Mankiewicz told me this. He said, and George did this masterful thing of laying out this case, telling the membership what DeMille had done. And suddenly John Ford stood up. And John Ford was a little to the right himself. And so Joe said, oh, my God, Ford's going to get up and undo everything George has done. And Ford got up and said, C.B., he said, I've known you all my life, C.B. He said, you're one of the best directors we've ever had. But I don't like you, C.B., and I don't like a goddamn thing you stand for. And that sealed the deal, and Mankiewicz was reinstated. So that was one of the great stories of the Hollywood blacklist.
George Stevens, Jr., one thing I found really fascinating in reading all of these interviews, particularly a lot of the people talking, and you young folks coming up and all your new ideas. And, of course, they also said at the same time they don't make them like they used to. What's odd is that within a couple of years after these interviews, we had virtually a Hollywood second golden age. And I'm just wondering, now we're 30 years later, are we close to a third golden age, or is Hollywood going to fade away?
Well, it won't fade away. It's indestructible in a sense that in one form or the other it's going to survive because people need entertainment. What it really comes down to, these men in this book, the best of them, were the ones who managed to find a way to control their work and to make pictures and not have them compromised by the studio system. The filmmakers who are making good films today, Steven Spielberg controls his work, George Lucas controls his work, and to varying degrees, the others do. Mike Nichols. Mike's had his ups and downs commercially, but Mike has now gone to making films for television, doing brilliant work. So there will be fine films made. We just don't know how they're going to be made and who's going to make them. I refer to my father frequently for obvious reasons, but he was always conscious of not wanting to make the film that was going to be fashionable in 1953. You know, you might ask, and I think it's a lovely film, Brokeback Mountain, but I don't know how interesting Brokeback Mountain's going to be in 25 years because many films will have dealt with that subject by then, and it may not play so well because it was simply the first. You know, perhaps it will not be the best. So I think that films that are most interesting to me are the ones that stand the test of time.
How important is Oscar?
I think it's become more important than it should be. As the show becomes more and more and more of an event, and to put these equally skilled actors sitting out there with big close-up cameras, it's almost like the American Idol, you know, which one is going to be slapped in the face and which one's going to be brought up on the stage when the variation between their excellence is so minimal.
I found it interesting when people were talking about Oscar winners and good and bad ones. Today, I think the worst Oscar winner of all time is The Greatest Show on Earth. But at the time, maybe it didn't feel that way.
I think it did feel that way.
Really?
At the time. And another was, because I happened to be sitting there that night when the choice went for us the wrong way. Giant was nominated for the Academy Award, and everyone was kind of assuming my father won for Best Director. And do you know what the best film of that year was? Around the World in 80 Days, which is a film that you can't look at today. But Mike Todd was a very great impresario, and he promoted it wonderfully.
George Stevens, Jr., we seem to have entered this world of bifurcation where a film is either made for $5 million or it's made for $100.
Yeah. I think that's a big problem. Of the four of the films nominated for the Academy Award, Crash, Brokeback Mountain, Capote, and
Good Night and Good Luck.
Good Night and Good Luck were made for half the budget of Munich, the other film. There is this reality of the audience in movie theaters being the 16 to 24 year old audience. And if you were think about the golden age, would Casablanca, The Treasure of Sierra Madre, A Man for All Seasons, Lawrence of Arabia, if people were catering to the 16 to 24 year old audience, would those films ever have been made? I can only speak for myself, and right. I have films that I want to make. And you just have to be optimistic, and you figure that you're gonna get slapped down a lot, but one way or another, like George Clooney, like Ang Lee, like Mike Nichols, you'll find a way to make the story you want to make, whether it's for the theaters or for HBO, and good films will continue to be made.
What are you working on now?
I've written my first play. It's called Thurgood, and James Earl Jones is going to play Thurgood Marshall. It's a one-man play about the great civil rights lawyer and later Supreme Court justice. I wrote it because it was what I wanted to write, but I think it's a timely play in one sense because people are interested in the Supreme Court and interested in civil rights. A third aspect of it is that Marshall had great humor. So this, while it deals with important social issues, it's very entertaining.
You've been listening to an interview with George Stevens, Jr., whose book is Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.